Just press your microphone here.
By first of all changing the question. The question on the title is why is elimination so elusive? And I'm changing that as a historian to why was elimination so elusive? And I'm going to answer this by looking at three main topics. I mean, first of all, the status of leprosy in the colonial era, and then secondly, its position within missionary medicine, and then finally say something about the nature of the disease. So let's move on fairly quickly. Okay. The simple answer is that nobody in the colonial era thought about eliminating leprosy. It was largely a local problem for local towns, cities, regions. It largely occurred, certainly in the 19th century, in respect to what particular colonial governments should do about leprosy asylums or hospitals that had been established in various in various situations. Within the British Empire, it became a topic of concern for the imperial government only in the 1850s and the 1860s, when certain colonies in the West Indies wished to close their leper asylums because they thought that leprosy was not a contagious disease, and they put this to the doctors in London about what they should actually do about this. But it was never a priority for the imperial government. It was never a priority like malaria was, because of the reputation of the tropics as the white man's grave. It was never a problem like cholera, because cholera threatened trade through the imposition of quarantines on British ships leaving India, for example. It was never a problem like sleeping sickness for the imperial government, because of the social and political problems that created in Central Africa. And it was never a problem, it was never a tropical medicine priority like smallpox, say in India, where there were mass vaccination campaigns. So it was well down the list of priorities. And this was, of course, partly because it was not a direct threat to the Western colonists. It was not a threat to colonial armies. It was not a threat to plantation managers. It was a problem for the indigenous population, and then a relatively low incidence and sporadic outbreak. So the main problem for the colonial administration in this period was dealing with it at a local level, and it was largely about how did you manage these people, and particularly individuals for whom it was less about managing the individuals and rather the community reaction to people with a disease which was stigmatizing, which may have been which may or may not have been contagious, and I'll come back to that issue later. And so the first thing is that it was not a problem for the imperial state, for the local colonial governments. It was not a high priority for doctors in the colonial medical service, who were largely servicing the army or the expatriate community, or working in trade. So into this gap, if that's the right term, missionary medicine took on leprosy and made leprosy its perhaps iconic disease. So the first thing is elimination is the wrong term. If we move on to missionary medicine, I mean, this is my favourite image of missionary medicine. It comes from an oil painting done in 1930, and I think this very much sums up the image of missionary medicine that the missionary societies wanted to promote at home, where medicine was an entree for conversion to Christianity. And the emphasis on missionary medicine was very much about clinical. It was very clinical. It was about care. It was not. It did not have a public health focus. I mean, it's quite interesting that if you look at missionary autobiographies, a medical missionary who arrived in a particular district would build the church before they built the clinic. And the clinic before they built a hospital. So the priority was conversion and care, and certainly not not a public health concern. What they tended to build was leper asylums, or in some cases colonies. The illustration here is from an illustration from the Mission to Lepers in India, which was a missionary charity. And they were building refuges, really, to take stigmatized individuals out of the community, to provide care, to provide an example of Christian Christian service, and as we're seeing in the moment, Christian self-sacrifice. And it was largely through particular moments. It was the pressure by missionary groups. I mean, the illustration here I've put up, because it was the Mission to Lepers in India that put the position of leprosy on the imperial medical map in the 1880s and early 1890s, when it pressurized the imperial government and the Indian government to set up the Indian Leprosy Commission. So it was missionary medicine acting as a lobby for this particular disease and wishing to move it up the priority list of the in this case the Indian government, but more generally the colonial government, and the missionaries were seeking more leper asylums, greater number of colonies, and this was again linked to the Christian mission. Of course, leprosy had obvious biblical resonance, and it was symbolic of the kind of self-sacrifice. And I'm sure you all recognise Father Damien here, who was, I mean, certainly the leprosy missionaries' most effective kind of marketing image from the 1890s onwards. And it's quite interesting that if one talks to, I mean, certainly people who are in the Catholic Church my age, I mean, remember collecting money for lepers in the 1950s and the 1960s, and the image of the leper child and the image of Father Damien was a very powerful image for kind of selling missionary medicine and its funding and its aims to the community, to the European Western community. And indeed, Father Damien's profile, as these illustrations show, is still with us today. There's the there's the film Molokai, which was, I think, in the 1990s. He's on a Belgian stamp. This is his statue outside, I think, the Parliament Building in Hawaii. And the image here is, I think, a cigarette card from the 1950s, showing an individual who thinks not of themselves, is prepared to kind of work closely with contagious, stigmatized individuals, and to represent missionary medicine at home in a way which I think was very powerful. The final point I want to make, and I want to kind of dwell on this more because it's, as a medical historian, it's probably the thing that I'm most interested in, is that leprosy was, for the colonial medical service, a very enigmatic disease. I mean, it was interesting, I'll just move on to an image and come back. I think it's interesting that this series is styled Tropical Diseases, Lessons from History. I mean, this is the map of the incidence of leprosy, I think, from the Indian Leprosy Commission thing. And of course, it shows that from a European perspective, it had a very high incidence in Norway. And we don't think about Norway as being tropical, and we don't think about Iceland or Greenland, other places here, as tropical. So it appeared to Europeans to be a very kind of difficult disease to conceptualize. I mean, it was known, certainly in Europe, that there were obviously lepers in biblical times, or individuals who were called lepers. Whether they suffered from modern leprosy is of course another matter, or whether it was a term simply for the disabled, I think is something that historians are kind of uncertain about. But there were leper asylums, leper hospitals in central London, in the medieval period, and these spread right across Europe. So one of the European ideas was that leprosy was a disease of earlier stages of civilization, and that as societies became more civilized, whatever that meant, the disease would perhaps naturally die out. If you look at this map, what that showed is that there appeared to be no obvious environmental link to patterns of incidence. The majority of places that are reported of high incidence, these are the dark red areas. The pink areas are those of a lesser thing. The majority are tropical, but it's not obviously a tropical disease. And then within these communities, although Norway is uniformly coloured red, the disease was not present everywhere. It was actually in specific locations within Norway, and so it didn't map onto any particular kind of obvious geographical epidemiological pattern. And this was a puzzle. And if one looks at India, I mean, these are a set of images from the Indian Leprosy Commission, published in 1891. This is the pattern of incidence in India in the 1881 census, with the darker areas showing the areas of greater incidence. And the commission puzzled over how one explained this. For example, the highest incidence is right up in the north of India, and it's, you know, and it doesn't obviously go with temperature. And there were various attempts to try to map what it did go with. They looked at salt levels. They mapped this incidence against the price of salt, because it was thought that salt levels might be a factor. And if you move this forward, this was the level of incidence in the 1891 census. But the critical map was this one, which was that the assumption of the Indian government, and indeed what had been promoted by the Indian mission for lepers, was that leprosy in India was actually increasing. Whereas what this map shows is that in the blue areas, the disease was actually declining between 1881 and 1891. It's only in the red areas that the disease was actually increasing. And the commission could come up with no satisfactory explanation as to what was actually changing in these districts, in the blue districts, as opposed to the red districts, in terms of what was kind of going on with leprosy in this period. And they were still faced by the fact that at this time it was the leading centre for leprosy research was still Norway, and Hansen was kind of becoming a major figure at this time. But earlier on, Burke and Danielson had been the major figures. So again, there was this puzzle about was this a tropical disease or not. In the British case, as I mentioned earlier, there was an ongoing debate from the 1860s to the 1890s about whether leprosy was contagious or not. And the practical issue here was, should colonial governments support leper asylums or leper hospitals, and should they enforce segregation? The dominant advice coming from the experts in London was that leprosy was non-contagious, and that leper asylums and leper hospitals and segregation could be abandoned. And local colonial governments, governors, certainly welcomed this as an opportunity to cut local spending. But they were then faced by local European communities complaining about lepers being let back onto the streets. There were worries about employing members of leper families as house servants, and as workers. So there was a whole series of countervailing pressures on local colonial governments, from local lay pressure groups through to imperial directives. And if one looks at the Colonial Office correspondence, there are repeated letters from district administrators, colonial governors, to the colonial office in London saying, what should we do about our local lepers? Should we be segregating them? Should we be leaving them alone? And these were all referred to the Royal College of Physicians and Gavin Milroy, and the message came back always that it's non-contagious. But while this was the official word, there was a whole series of other books being published arguing that it was contagious and segregation was the way forward. And the Indian Leper Commission, which was set up in 1890, was supposed to settle this question once and for all, and actually advise the British government. And what it came up with was a view that leprosy was, the term that historians use, is contingently contagious. That is, that it is contagious in certain conditions, and more contagious in some conditions than in others. And the actual Leprosy Commission report came up with the finding that it was contagious, but it was so difficult to specify what the nature of this contagion was, because it wasn't clear how the bacillus was transmitted, it wasn't clear what the incubation period is, it wasn't clear what the portals of entry were, it wasn't clear whether there were healthy carriers, that it was so mysterious that for policy purposes it could be regarded as non-contagious. And they looked at a whole set of, I mean, there were a whole set of other theories in play at the time. I've mentioned salt as a possibility, whether the salt intake of communities would predispose to leprosy. There was, of course, the idea that it was an inherited condition. And of course, this is pre-Mendel. This is not the idea that it's somehow in our genes, but rather that perhaps the poison, the germ, whatever, could be carried in the sperm or in the egg and might be passed from parent to child. The inheritance of acquired characteristics was still widely assumed by biologists and doctors, and there was still this persistent notion that it was something to do with eating rotting fish, and this went with the Norwegians, and the assumption that there were certain coastal communities in India where it was the case, and pre-bacteriology, it was assumed that there was some kind of poison in the fish, but post the identification of the Hansen bacillus, people began to search for the Hansen bacillus in various fishes all around the world. The Indian Leprosy Commission also did a significant amount of bacteriological work, and made various claims to have been able to culture the bacillus. The report was delayed by 6 months, 12 months, while certain of the pathological and bacteriological uncertainties were alleged to have been sorted, and there was great controversy both on the bacteriology and the recommendations for the essential closure of asylums and leper colonies, but these are some illustrations of cells infected with the leprobacillus, taken from a textbook from Hansen's textbook in 1895. And one of the interesting things which was going on at this time is that the similarities with tuberculosis were leading to leprosy being reframed, reconceived as a disease analogous to tuberculosis. And suggestions may be that the same kind of methods that were being applied to tuberculosis at this time, particularly open-air sanatoria, that perhaps leper colonies might not just have been for segregation, but how leading a healthy lifestyle, hygienic lifestyle in a controlled community might actually be a therapeutic way forward for lepers at this time. But certainly one of the major problems from the 1890s and it remains an ongoing problem is that the microorganism proved very difficult to manage in the laboratory. It was not as cooperative as the tubercular bacillus, if you like, where experimental animals were found relatively easily, and we know that it took many decades for an experimental animal for leprosy to emerge. Problems of culturing, problems of staining, problems of identification, all of these things meant that it remained a very problematic laboratory organism. And finally, when it comes to therapy, the leprosy hospitals until the 1920s were mainly concerned with segregation, except some hopes that a hygienic regime in these institutions might actually encourage the body to heal itself. One of the things which I've emphasized in my work on the history of bacteriology is that contemporaries at the time saw infectious diseases as very much in terms of the seed and soil metaphor. And I think when we look back at infectious diseases, and particularly discoveries in this era, too much emphasis has been given to the discovery of the seeds of disease, and not enough to the fact that many people who are infected don't go on to develop the disease. And certainly in the case of tuberculosis, the idea of many of the treatment regimes at this time was to try to strengthen the body, to strengthen the soil, in order to make it less fertile for the microorganism to develop. And that was that seems to me very much one of the hopes of leper asylums and leper colonies at this time. Of course, just stepping back, that although the Indian Leper Commission, the Indian Leprosy Commission for the British Empire in the mid-1890s recommended against segregation, the International Congress later in the decade came out strongly in favour of contagion. And so this issue about is it contagious, what is its status, continued forward into the 20th century. Finally, what changes in the early 20th century is the development of treatment. And certainly from the 1920s, there is great hope that Chalmugra oil is the breakthrough. That there are reports from the 19th century of using this externally on leprosy lesions. And from the early 20th century, attempts to give it orally, and then the development of injections with various modifications, various modifications of the oil. And certainly there was great hope in the 1920s. One of the key figures in Belra, the British Empire Leprosy Research Association, Leonard Rogers, became almost a kind of missionary himself for Chalmugra oil in the 1920s, and this illustration here from India shows the oil being prepared, and it became a kind of, I wouldn't say a standard treatment, but it became the only treatment. I mean, many people were still sceptical. There was disagreement about the dose, there was disagreement about the method of administration, there was disagreement about the length of time which people needed to actually be treated. And so leprosy remained, I mean, it comes back to my title here, it remained an enigmatic disease clinically in terms of treatment. Until the 1940s, with the development of cell phones, where, as this illustration shows, the promotion was that this was a disease, this was a one-pill disease almost, that this is a disease which could be treated by an antibiotic like other infectious diseases. And this began to change leprosy from a disease which needed to have separate asylums, separate colonies, to something which could be treated, as this suggests, could be treated in ordinary clinics ordinary hospitals. And I think this is where I will hand over to Dr. Nordine, because he's going to be talking about the attempts to deal with the leprosy problem in the contemporary era, which has been largely about the supply administration of drug therapies and the various institutions and various agencies that have been involved in that and the various goals that have been involved in that. So just to sum up, what I've tried to point out here is that elimination in the colonial era was never tried. It was always a local problem. It was dominated disease for almost the whole colonial era. It was dominated by missionaries. Even the Chalmugarol was promoted by a missionary voluntary society. It was not particularly pushed by state governments, regional governments, or the imperial government. Certainly in the British Empire, and that finally, from the 1860s right through to the 1940s, leprosy remained this enigmatic disease. It wasn't transformed by bacteriology. It proved difficult to manage in the laboratory. It proved problematic in terms of at the clinic. It wasn't clear what its instance was in the field. It was a disease that was kind of difficult to feel, and until that is, sulfones tended to come in and perhaps normalise it to other infectious diseases. But that's perhaps something to discuss later. So that's all. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mick. I think you've set the discussion up very nicely. I just want to take advantage of being chair to ask you a question. First of all, just to expand on one of the points you made about the growing desire in many colonial states for segregation in the 1890s. It's not coming just from Europeans or from just members of the colonial government. A large amount of the pressure is actually coming from affluent sections of the indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. And it's not simply fears of contagion. In fact, it's fears of contagion which often provide the pretext for incarceration of people who are regarded as being unsightly or troublesome because they're vagrants and beggars. And it's clearing people away sometimes out of public arenas and from temples and from the vicinities of the more affluent dwellings of, say, in the case of mm-hmm. India, of some of the Indian people, which really provides much of the impetus to this in the 1890s. My question is, I wonder, you know, how far the economic and political factors that you mentioned at the start were actually, or the kind of the lack of political and economic impact of leprosy was really the main reason why it failed to have the kind of priority that, say, malaria or cholera mm-hmm. and plague did in many cases. In fact, I think you kind of hit on the real reason for neglect really at the end, and I think the sort of the economic and political dimensions in a sense were red herring. I think it's really ultimately about technology, about the sense of possibility. Because if you say if you take smallpox, for mm-hmm. instance, for much of the 19th century, many of the European colonies, smallpox is given a great deal of priority, but it's not particularly important as a threat to the colonial regime, because most of the Europeans themselves can be vaccinated against it. It's not terribly economically important mm-hmm. or politically important in the way that, say, cholera or plague is, because these are diseases which create very disruptive epidemics which invite unwelcome attention from other powers, trade embargoes, and so on and so forth. Smallpox doesn't really have any of that, but what elevates it to the very often the top of the agenda on an almost annual basis, say from the early 19th century through to the end of colonial rule, is the fact that basically there is a technology available which is reasonably effective in preventing this disease, and it's the fact that it can be prevented, which demonstrates the the superiority of Western medicine, mm-hmm. the benevolence mm-hmm. and superiority of colonial regimes. The fact that it exemplifies the civilizing mission is really what gives it. It's what really provides most of the impetus to the smallpox control or later sort of eradication campaigns. And leprosy lacks all of that. I mean, it has some of the other resonances, like it's smallpox has in the sense that the desire to eliminate it is a way of demonstrating civilization, but it's just boils down basically to the lack of an effective preventional treatment. I think mm-hmm. I don't know if you'd like to comment on.
Okay, well, I mean just two. I mean your first point about what was a leper and what did they stand for? I mean, I mentioned in the medieval period, it's not clear that everybody who was labelled a leper in the medieval period actually had leprosy in our terms. And I think that's, I mean, it may be the case that a whole set of people with various physical disabilities were labelled lepers in the late 19th century. I mean, I think people have speculated about whether people would say club foot or some other kind of limb deformity might have been labelled or stigmatised as lepers, and so I think that's an open question. I think in terms of smallpox being a technical fix, whereas to continue to use that language, you could argue that leprosy required a social fix. That is, it required institutions and support. I mean, it was certainly. I agree that that's the case. But I think the thing was that smallpox was approached at a national level. It was a kind of, it was something which was a kind of top-down. I mean, it was something which was imported from Britain, whereas leprosy was always a kind of local problem that was dealt with locally and was never taken up at the top level. I don't think it never registered that level. And I think maybe to argue that it was because there wasn't a technical fix is perhaps a bit presentist in the sense of there weren't necessarily technical fixes for many conditions at this time. But I take the point that smallpox could be seen as a symbol of Western of Western's supremacy. But then in the same way, the ability to segregate and isolate and eradicate diseases by by isolation was something which was kind of, in a way, seen as a technical fix in Europe with the creation of isolation hospitals and those, you can think about isolation hospitals as a social technology for separating off things. And it seems to me no reason why the isolation hospital or the segregated leper colony couldn't also be seen as a kind of Western, as an example of Western Western superiority and a Western answer to a kind of local problem. But we can pursue that later.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Professor Walvoers? I think there's one. Oh, it's one at the back. You can see.
You focused on the issue of elimination in the colonial period.
If you give you a microphone, Mike, I'd like to pick you up a little more, if you don't mind.
Because of the question, you focused on elimination and the colonial view of the disease. But particularly if you take the example of India, you have the history of Ayurvedic medicine. And does the literature there provide a viewpoint on what we now call leprosy? And were there some perspectives there that either could have or did at the time influence how to deal with leprosy as a disease?
Right. I'm not an expert on Indian medicine. Mark might be able to answer that better than I can. But I'm not aware that there were Ayurvedic thing. Are you?
Well, I could say something afterwards. I could say something afterwards, but I don't know if you should be kind of answering the other questions.
No. You're the Indian expert, not me.
Well, I mean, In terms of the impact of those, in terms of the impact of Ayurvedic conceptions of leprosy on what the British actually thought, I think there is some evidence that at the very beginning of the 19th century that they had an impact upon the classification of the disease and distinctions between elephantiasis and leprosy. But beyond that, and particularly at the time that Mick is talking about, I don't think that they really register as far as the British is concerned. Of course, among many sections of the Indian population, of course, they still tend to dominate. And I think probably Dr. Nordine knows a great deal more about that.
I'd like a brief comment. Leprosy is very well described in Ayurveda and in its various forms, with probably several possible treatment methods. Even Indian the commission on leprosy set up the British, when they went round, they came across a number of treatments, mostly oils, gurjun oil, even shalmuga has some roots in Ayurveda. They were being used for treatment of leprosy. Isolation of leprosy patients was practiced in India before in the pre-colonial area. The sanatorium where I used to work 60 years ago near Chennai was originally located in another place which had been functioning for another 200 years before that, set up by a charitable endowment.
Justin, I'd like to talk a bit more about this kind of lack of international attention to leprosy mid to late 19th mm-hmm. century, perhaps more the late 19th century. Considering that questionnaire sent out by the Royal College of Physicians, mm-hmm. I think there was also a German questionnaire sent out and also a French one. And then we've got the Leprosy Commission. And an enormous body, I'm not sure in comparison to other diseases, and I think, yes, you're talking in comparison to other diseases, but in terms of leprosy, a fairly large body of literature over that period, and debates that went into the public sphere, particularly the newspapers, the Times. So this missionary concern about leprosy, I'm not sure how much credit I think we have to give it quite a bit of credit for directing attention to the disease and directing alarm for certain purpose, for their own purposes. But the debate that spread then into the public sphere and also into the medical journals and literatures of the time, now how much that influenced the political mm-hmm. decisions that were made is another matter. Mm-hmm. But it's actually a very complex period, isn't it, in its response to leprosy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the thing I just mentioned briefly was the International Congress in the late 1898, yeah. Which came down decisively in favour of contagion, and that was in a way kind of dominated, I think, by German bacteriologists of the Koch School who were promoting isolation, disinfection as a method of dealing with a whole range of infectious diseases. But as you say, whether the pronouncements of international commissions on diseases, and I think WHO is probably a good place, perhaps not the best place to say this, whether the pronouncements of international commissions, how they are then translated down into national, local, regional, and then local health agencies and decision making, I think, is a separate issue. But certainly, I think from the medical perspective, that commission was quite decisive, and certainly I think changed the balance of opinion in the Anglophone Anglophone world in favour of a kind of Germanic contagionist model, and away from the kind of contingent or anti-contagionism earlier. But this was, I think, in the larger context, this was the period when kind of medicine itself went international, and there was a growing number of international meetings, international medical congresses. There had been meetings the International Sanitary Commission had met from the 1860s, but the development of the railways and shipping meant that there was a growing number of these international meetings from the 1880s onwards, which many medics tied in with kind of tourism, kind of scientific tourism, if you like. Junketing, I think, is now the term, and it's quite interesting when you look at the things about all of the outings that went along with that. So I think there are a growing number of these international international meetings, and they do become very important. I mean, not just for the disease, but they're actually important for the countries that host these diseases in putting their kind of medical community on the map. But I think I come back to the point that kind of just how that filters down to actual decisions on the ground is a matter where you need to look at national, regional, and local contexts.
Well, I think we should probably move on to our next speaker now, too, so we've provided enough time for questions for Dr. Nordine. But thank you very much, Mick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The title of the topic given to me was Leprosy from the Global Public Health Perspectives. Well, it follows from the previous speaker. I added a subtitle, The Successes, the Challenges, and the Opportunities. Apart from the public health perspective, there are two other perspectives which are very important for leprosy and very extremely interesting. Firstly, the social perspective, the other, the medical perspective. I will not go into that. The recognition of leprosy as a public health problem in the real sense of public health is fairly recent, about 50, 60, 70 years at the most. There are several interesting features about leprosy which gives us unique opportunities to intervene. One of the first is, as you even pointed out earlier, it's a very unevenly distributed disease among countries and even within countries. And this means if you are able to identify those areas where the problem is most, then you will be able to target extremely well. Again, leprosy is feebly infectious, and only a small proportion of the patients are bacteriologically positive. Even in the worst of circumstances, no more than 2 or 3% of the population get leprosy. Again, even for contacts of leprosy patients, people who live with leprosy patients, the annual risk is only around 1 to 2%. But then, because leprosy is a chronic disease where people can be exposed for many years, the lifetime risk for contacts is much higher because they're exposed for several years. Again, most of leprosy is mild and self-healing. It's only a small proportion that progresses to severe disease, and the accumulation of this progressive disease that leads to the reservoir of infection and the leprosy as we see it as a prevalence. For a long time, with a limited understanding or enigmatic, as he said, leprosy could not be addressed as a public health problem. The best possible was isolation, but as mentioned earlier, isolation is often practiced as a social measure to keep people out of sight. And of course, even later on, when they used public health justification, the real reason was to keep people out of sight. But of course, some of these institutions gave a good degree of care for these individuals. The first effective change in this was in the public health approach was with the advent of effective treatment and the possibility of reducing the infectious burden in the community and consequently transmission. These were not so much talked about during the Shalmugra days in the 1920s or 30s, but started picking some momentum with the advent of cell phone drugs, that here is a drug which possibly cures, and maybe we can reduce infection, infectious reservoir, and maybe we can reduce transmission. And the domiciliary treatment in the field was instituted in the 50s in several situations with fairly good results in the beginning. And there are many, there's a much hope that if properly expanded, adoption would lead to a big public health impact. But this was belied by two reasons. One, Dapsone treatment is a very long-term treatment, some very often lifelong treatment, and compliance of patients to such treatment was very low. Secondly, over a period of time, by 1960s, we found Dapsone treatment led to resistance of Mycobacterium malaria against the drug, leading to a lot of treatment failures and relapses. From time to time, other approaches have been considered, particularly the possibility of developing an anti-leprosy vaccine. If I remember correct, I saw some years ago somewhere a bottle of anti-leprosy vaccine prepared in the 1930s by Wellcome. Anyway, that was the interest in the vaccine, but the real interest came with TDR, with the possibility of growing MLPA in animal models like armadillos. The possibility of producing vaccine through this model was considered, and there's a lot of excitement in TDR, and immunology leprosy program was really the flagship of TDR. It was started even before TDR, and it was this development that brought a lot of attention to leprosy. Of course, we already knew that BCG gave a limited amount of protection against leprosy. Now, coming back to other interventions, chemoprophylaxis was considered as a possibility, including more recently single dose rifampicin. But the major problem is the household contacts of patients, of course, are easily identifiable group. They are certainly higher risk compared with others. However, with a low frequency disease like leprosy, household contacts contribute only a very small proportion of the total population. This means even with a fivefold increased risk, because of very, very limited population size, contacts contribute only a minority of new cases, 20-25% in the community. The rest of the cases coming from the so-called low-risk general population. This means that chemoprophylaxis is highly effective, it has serious limitations as a public health measure, unless you are able to cover whole populations with chemoprophylaxis, which is something inconceivable. Thus, from the public health point of view, intervention through effective chemotherapy became the only option. And research in breakthroughs in the 1960s and 70s, a lot of it contributed through TDR, opened great opportunities to have highly effective bactericidal chemotherapy, and the potential not only to cure leprosy, but to also greatly reduce the reservoir of infection in the community. Such an effective cure came up ultimately through multi-drug therapy in the 1980s, which was capable of making the patient non-infectious in a very short period of time, and also capable of effectively addressing the problem of drug resistance. But with MDD, there was a great opportunity to bring about a steep reduction in the disease burden. This was envisaged through the recognition that a large majority of leprosy burden in the 1990s was the result, or 80s, and was the result of untreated backlog of prevalent cases in the community that could be treated through vigorous field treatment programs. And secondly, the expectation that such subsequent treatment of backlog cases will reduce the occurrence of new cases and slow further reduction in the disease burden. The first years of experience after introduction of MDT demonstrated that expectations are well justified. MDT was found to be a robust treatment and well accepted. It was clear that with further intensification, a lot more progress could be done. MDT had a low frequency of side effects. It hasn't produced problems of drug resistance to date in any significant way, and it is fairly well accepted by patients. So, with such an initial development, positive development, the question came, can we do more than what we are doing at the time in the end of 1980s, with further intensification? Thus came the concept of elimination of leprosy as a public health problem, a public health strategy with great potential to garner support from all concerned. This was in the beginning of the 1990s. So this was translated, taken forward, and the World Health Assembly in 1991 was able to adopt a resolution committing the organization and its member countries to a goal of elimination of leprosy as a public health problem by the year 2000, defining elimination as attaining a level of prevalence below one case per 10,000. This is slightly different definition from what in other diseases the term elimination is used. The deadline and the prevalence cutoff point were narrowed arbitrarily to some extent, but provided a great opportunity to bring about a major impact. This was a truly historic step in the annals of both WHO and leprosy. The prerequisites for attaining the goal included the need for strong WHO leadership, genuine national commitments, availability of MDT drugs free of cost, adequate NGO and donor support, and sufficient awareness creation among the in the community. The prerequisites were met to a large extent. This is the most gratifying part, resulting in unprecedented progress towards the goal. In simple terms, this is what you see at the time of the World Health Assembly resolution and now. At that time, in 1992, registered cases was close to 3 million. Today, it's around 200,000, a reduction of over 90%. And in terms of rate, it's about the same. Currently, the rate, prevalence rate per 10,000 population globally is 0.33. The number of new cases used to be around 650,000. Now it's around 250, a reduction of over 60%. The number of new cases, the detection rate again has come down to a level of about 0.38 per 10,000 population. Now this is the graph some of you might have seen in terms of showing how there's a steep decline in prevalence of cases and there hardly any change in the occurrence of new cases or case detection. And often the statement that is repeated everywhere is leprosy elimination may be a success to some extent, but new cases continue to occur. That is partly true, and that new cases continue to occur at the same rate. Now this graph, which is often projected, does not show the real story. If you put this in two different scales, you can see what happened. The blue line is the occurrence of new cases, and you will see for the last 7 years at least, the new case detections are declining very rapidly. And of course, the bottom one is the prevalence. So because the small numbers, if you plot in the same graph, you don't see these changes. In spite of the excellent overall progress, there are countries which show considerable slowing down or stagnation in terms of new case detection. These difficult countries, I would roughly about 8, include Brazil, Indonesia, Ethiopia, Congo, Tanzania, Mozambique, Angola, and Sri Lanka. These countries together, which used to contribute to less than 1/10 of leprosy burden in 1990s, currently contribute about 1/3 of leprosy burden. Even among the 8, 2 important countries are Brazil and Indonesia. These are the 8 countries where case detection rates are really going up or stabilizing, which is a serious concern. Now, if you look at the new case detection trends, the bottom one, of course, is in the same scale. These 8 countries show the fairly steady case detection rates. But if you look at three other lines on the above, the global picture I already shown you in the red is already there. And then you have the green one, that is India. India with a huge proportion of leprosy cases contribute to the global burden and the global progress substantially. But if you look at other countries, other than the eight, the pattern is also very similar, suggesting globally we're having very good results with new case detection, but not necessarily in the eight countries I mentioned earlier. And these eight, even among these eight countries, you will find Brazil and Indonesia dominate the scene much more than the other countries. Okay, I'm telling you how the prevalence rates were influenced by both operational factors as well as factors, epidemiological factors. These are some details. Apart from reduction transmission, there are also other factors contributing to this. Similarly, case detection is also influenced by operational factors of detection and reporting, apart from reduction transmission. So in summary, there are currently 220,000 registered cases worldwide. Less than 23,000 of them are likely to be bacteriologically positive. Estimated number of disabled, including the world cured patients, is a maximum of 500,000. Occurrence of new cases appears to be around 260,000 per year, which is expected to diminish progressively as a high proportion of current new cases appear to be due to breakdown of old subclinical infections, particularly among older individuals. In terms of leprosy elimination, all countries have attained their goal of prevalence rate of less than 1 in 10,000, except for 3 or 4 countries. Apart from the numbers, the quality of new leprosy cases over the years has greatly changed for the better. Compared to cases diagnosed 2 decades ago, today new leprosy cases have mostly early and minimal disease, have very few deformities at diagnosis, and have an extremely low proportion with skin smear positive picture. Currently, leprosy tends to cling to certain geographic areas and populations. These areas and populations need to be identified and dealt with. There is also a hidden problem of undetected cases among underserved communities. As a very low frequency disease, leprosy increasingly poses logistic problems in providing proper technical support and drug supply at appropriate levels. For instance, in many areas, a health center may not see a case, may see a case only once in 2 years, in which case to organize both technical support to confirm diagnosis and to ensure drugs are there in place is not easy. Fortunately, drug resistance is not a problem in leprosy. Relapse rates, which can be due to either persisting organisms or drug resistance, is still only around 1 per 1,000 per year. And most of these relapses respond to retreatment, indicating that they are not due to drug resistance. In conclusion, from public health point of view and in comparison with other major problems of communicable disease, leprosy may be a relatively small problem in the global context, but it still continues to be an important problem in certain parts of the world or in certain countries. There is therefore great need to work further towards making leprosy a totally insignificant problem everywhere through focused, intensified activities. This is certainly doable and, as has been demonstrated, in several parts of the world. So in conclusion, in terms of the title that was used by the other speaker, leprosy is certainly a disease where we are winning and we will win. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Nordin. I think that the, for me, I mean, it's certainly, as you say, a very, very positive picture. But what I didn't quite understand was why exactly is the leprosy problem such a stubborn one in countries such as Indonesia and Brazil? Because, I mean, you know, some certain obvious things come to mind, like, you know, the geographical distances, you know, the difficult nature of terrain creating logistical problems. But, you know, one could also say that's true of a country like India, which is also, you know, seemingly very successful. So why is it specifically, say, in those two countries among, you know, those eight that you have such enormous problems?
I think there are no common answers to all these countries. Each country is specific in its own way. And some of my colleagues will probably substantiate that even with their problems, these countries are problem countries. In a sense, for various reasons. If you take, for instance, in Brazil, on the technical side, there is a very strong technical group which will never accept what WHO says. MDT was not accepted for 12 years in Brazil because they thought they knew better than WHO. And only more recently, they have started applying MDT. That means they'll take more time to reach. Secondly, on the technical side, leprosy would be treated only by dermatologists in Brazil till recently. No health worker can treat leprosy, whereas leprosy can very easily be treated by a three-month-old health worker, three-month-trained health worker. And more, only recently, the physicians other than dermatologists are allowed to treat leprosy. So these are individual country situations. In Indonesia, again, decentralization is playing havoc with healthcare in some of the control programs. So, and countries like Congo and others are involved in civil strife and war and all that. So there are always problems there. So what I'm indicating is one has to study individual situations and individual problems and apply appropriate solutions and not try a blanket approach everywhere of the same intervention.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, just to mention that we're talking about Brazil, and Brazil has been struggling with the leprosy issue. There's a recent news from the Minister of Health is that in the last couple of weeks they decide to go back to the avoiding the elimination concept. So they want to do control for leprosy, saying that the terminology of elimination, once you reach the level of elimination in some specific areas, the potential for mobilizing resource and continual case detections and treatment is going to disappear. So they want to go back to control of leprosy and not use anymore the elimination 1/10 concept. This is a recent...
This is the dilemma we are facing. Leprosy elimination is going to make a lot of people out of work. And this means there's a great resistance to see less leprosy. And in Brazil, I would say, they're influenced to some extent by this. So if you're not able to do elimination, the alternative is not lower your sight and say, we'll do a lesser job. Instead of intensifying your activities to do the right job. And it's been extremely complex, and to some extent I would say WHO has not been providing the right leadership in these areas, right aggressive leadership.
To some extent I think PAHO is supporting this change from elimination to control.
I'm not so sure. Even in PAHO there are two views.
A few years ago, WHO moved the program of leprosy from headquarters to India. So, to have this helped or not helped the eight difficult countries, what do you call them, eight difficult countries? Okay. The other question is, can leprosy be integrated in other programs rather than to be vertical in this program? Because many of the diseases are in the same area sometimes.
Okay. Leprosy is integrated to a large extent. There's no 100% integration, no 100% vertical. There's always elements of verticality in integrated programs, etc. But coming back to the question of leprosy being shifted from the headquarters to the regional office, it has its pluses and minuses. The plus is WHO likes to very much these days to outsource all their problems. And so in one sense, leprosy is outsourced to zero. In terms of the negative aspect, the interaction between leprosy and other components of WHO is minimal, because technically headquarters is highly well organized compared to the regional offices. So in one sense, that's a big loss. But I don't have a clear answer to that.
Any other? Yeah.
The distribution of leprosy, even from historical times, has always been uneven. Yeah. And it still continues to be uneven. Yeah. And you mentioned that it clings to certain geographical areas and certain populations. What is the modern, for modern research, what is the, is there any better understanding of this? I mean, is it just historical reasons or is there epidemiological reasons?
No, we have no answer. We won't say this is a characteristic of the disease. Even within a small geographic area, you will find prevalences.
But in that regard, is it related to socioeconomic factors primarily, or
because it's not related to? So in general, leprosy thrives in low socioeconomic conditions, and when low socioeconomic conditions disappear and situation get better, leprosy disappears even without a health intervention. Good. The classic example is countries like Korea, China, South Africa.
Norway, I suppose.
Yeah. Norway, okay, long ago.
I was just wondering, actually, about the new case detection trend lines that you showed. I was wondering if you calculated the world minus India, because India seems to basically be driving all of the world trends so much. I was just curious about that.
It'll be the same as what I showed, the top three graphs. India minus India, world minus India will be the same.
To get to the end of leprosy or to move further on, is it just a matter of organization of health systems and programs, or is there still some value in technical innovation? And if so, what?
Okay. Leprosy is a disease will disappear once it reaches a very low level, like in Norway, like in Japan, like in Great Britain, even starting from 80, 90 years ago. So it will disappear, but it will have a very slow disappearance for a long period of time. So we don't expect any new interventions to be introduced at that very low level. If you have one in a million cases, one case in a million population, what kind of intervention is going to be easy? Certainly leprosy is not a threat in terms of an epidemic or even a resurgence. A lot of people talk that leprosy is going to be malaria. You are coming down and you are going to reduce your attention and it's going to boom, come back. Leprosy will never it will never happen in leprosy, because there's enough historical evidence that once leprosy comes down, resurgence is not possible. Okay, certainly WHO has a lot of experience in missing targets. Leprosy is not the only one. We had a target in the World Assembly Resolution of 2005. At that time, by 2000, we still had a dozen countries not reaching the goal. 2005, about six, now about three or four. So, and they're very difficult countries, as they mentioned, like Brazil or Indonesia, they'll take much more time. But certainly, we should not worry too much about the last one or two countries and look at the whole thing as a failure. Because these countries, which are exceptions, make the whole situation look very bad. It is not true.
I would like to make a question about the targets. It's true that the WHO set a lot of targets for several diseases. Not always we will be able to eliminate them. But I think, anyhow, these targets are important as a indication what should be done. Even if it's not reached, anyhow, mobilize people, mobilize institution, donors, and then it's also demonstrate that it's possible to do something concrete. Is also the case for leprosy, what do you think?
Certainly. See, in the 1991 WHO resolution can be criticized ad nauseum about the deadline, about the cutoff point, many things. But this is a commitment which enabled political commitment at country level, donor support, For instance, since 1995, every patient in the world is getting anti-leprosy drugs, MDT, free of cost. Every patient in the world. This would not have been possible without such commitment.
Information when you showed the incidence trends, there was a peak around the end of last century, 2000 or so. What was that due to?
No, there are many operational factors in that. I can go into great detail. Campaigns, when you set up a special campaign, you suddenly pick up a lot of cases. And then something happens, it comes down. So these are short-term changes. What people say is, you come down to close to zero, wait for another 20 years, then it comes back. In the case of malaria, it was much shorter period. But in leprosy, it's not like malaria.
For Dr. Nordin, any questions? Yeah, one more.
What happened about the leprosy vaccine? Is it being completely abandoned, or is there still
anywhere? Oh, I didn't want to discourage the TDR people here. I said IMLEP was a great success in bringing attention to leprosy. IMLEP was a total failure as far as vaccine was concerned, for many reasons. But certainly it built up scientific interest. It built up a lot of other work. Chemotherapy of leprosy scientific working group started 3 years later, and every immunologist in the group in IMLEP would say, what are these people counting red pills and white pills and green pills and all that? But IMLEP succeeded in enabling MDT and making leprosy elimination success.
I think it's worth pointing out that there are many tropical diseases.
But I think perhaps a side product of the trials with the leprosy vaccine was to prove that BCG has a protection effect.
But it's already known 40 years earlier.
Well, but it was possible to quantify at least the numbers of vaccination and the intensity of a protection and so on. As it was used as a control arm of the trials.
Sorry, I just wanted to say quickly, This has been a great start to this series, and I don't want to slow the discussion down at all. But, Rob, would you mind if I provoked you a little bit on this? Do you have a sense of whether a series of seminars like this is helpful to you and your colleagues in TDR, or what you're looking for in particular from this sort of exchange?
Well, I think it's not such, but it's particularly TDR or any others in WHO, whether that be in NTD or be in the health system strengthening group or anywhere. So I don't think it should be targeted at one unit. But I think getting a historical perspective and seeing, getting often through the historical perspective, a view of the disease 100-150 years ago, because we're always trapped in the present. Young people coming through, their view of the disease is what they've read in the literature for the last 5-10 years. It's very rare that you get that historical perspective, and I think that difference in perspective is useful. And then getting the hands-on experience of how things have progressed in the recent history from the likes of Professor Noradin, I think these are all very helpful. And Dr. Noradin also has been very open and frank in his statements, and from a research perspective, if people have very frank and firm statements about what they think should be done for research, then we're very willing to hear those comments. That was the reason for my last question. Whether we should be involved in research or not in an area is a critical question, for example. So can't speak for all my colleagues, but I think it has been a useful first start. And when we were discussing the series, the idea was that we should try and challenge current dogmas and positions as much as study previous dogmas and positions, because you mentioned the 1898 meeting. I mean, the outcome, the nature of the discussion in 1898, if you had a similar thing today on another disease, it's pretty much the same socially what's happening. The types of discussion and arguments, the different positions, one school of thought versus another school of thought. Things haven't progressed as much maybe as we'd like to think in our rational approach to science. And I think it's always worth reminding us of, I think if you look at the past weaknesses, they remind us also of our current weaknesses.
I think Professor Warboys had a point to make.
Well, it was just a technical point about vaccines and innovation, that the Wellcome vaccine that you saw was actually probably a therapeutic vaccine. Because in the 1920s, well, from the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, there was a significant development in Britain and elsewhere towards producing therapeutic vaccines. Indeed, the major producer of these in London was Alexander Fleming. Before he was against chemotherapy and antibiotics. He saw no future of them for them until 1940. But it worked on the assumption that, and leprosy was a good model for this, that if you have a local infection, then why hasn't that alerted? The question was, if you have a local infection, is it present? Does it persist because the rest of the body's immune system hasn't been alerted and didn't know it was there? And so Fleming and his laboratory had an industry of collecting material from lesions, producing killed vaccines, and then selling them, and they had a gradation of these from, I think it was for a very expensive set, where you could go and get your own vaccine made for your own from your own germs, through to stock vaccines, and Wellcome produced a lot of these therapeutic vaccines. And of course, in terms of the possibilities of therapeutic rather than preventive vaccines, this sometimes comes back. I mean, it's come back, I think, in pneumonia. In the 1990s, there was a possibility. So it was just a technical point about.
Okay, well, I hope you agree it's been. Oh, there's more. Okay, thank you. We have time for probably needs to be the last question.
Maybe the problem is with this term is not with leprosy, but with elimination. That we've had other WHO elimination goals. The neonatal tetanus comes to mind. There's an assembly resolution as well. And that's also faded into the background and been largely forgotten. So elimination in a way is artificial. It's not like smallpox eradication. The goal was zero cases and then it's gone. The program is finished. There's no more smallpox program. So maybe this term elimination is problematic. And since there is no zero endpoint, then one should maybe think about sunsetting it. That there hasn't been any work in leprosy to integrate it into health systems or primary health care. And should this be for future, if we're looking to reduce diseases to a certain level, there should then be a follow-up to hand it over for maintenance to the routine health services.
It speaks the integration debate. Integration should start right early, right from the beginning. Okay. But in this case, I don't think that is intent. I mean, the integration has already started in leprosy in most places.
Well, I think the number of questions is an indication this has been a very stimulating start to the series, and I hope you will join me in thanking both of our speakers today.
For those of you who'd like to continue chatting and discussing and maybe having a cup of coffee at the same time, I think there are certain possibilities, so make your contacts if you want them, and we'll see you outside. Thanks again, everybody, for coming.